You're listening to the Round Table Podcast, episode 19.
Hello, everyone. I'm Brian Humphrey.
And I'm Dave Robison.
And you're listening to the Round Table Podcast.
Each week on the Round Table Podcast, Brian and I invite writers to come onto the show and pitch a story idea to us and our esteemed guest host.
And then we dig into it, root around a little bit, talk about what works, what doesn't work, kick around some ideas, and try to fine-tune it into a solid and writable story.
Give me my cue. Dude, give me my cue. You're leaving me hanging.
And so
what Dave likes to call.
Oh, what? Okay, I'm sorry.
Jeez. What is this?
Well,
episode 15? 16?
I thought you didn't want it to sound scripted. So, you know, I was going off script a little bit.
Yeah, going way off script. But there's off script and then there's signature. Damn it.
Script. All right. And try to fine-tune it into a solid and writable story, which Dave likes to call...
No, I don't want to do it now. Fuck it.
Oh, my God.
All right. You know what? Here. Okay. Then we dig into it, root around a little bit, talking about what works and what doesn't work, kick around some ideas, and try to fine-tune it into a solid and writable story and what I like to call literary gold.
That was good. That was very good. We can roll with that.
Well, thank you.
As long as we get the literary gold out there, because the alchemy vibe is what we're rocking.
Good Lord.
I think we've used up our minute and a half, Bri, screwing around.
There's not a lot new, you know, going
no,
on.
No, there isn't. There isn't. Our lives are all about podcasting and recording podcasts.
Yeah, and they don't care about us. They care about our guests.
Absolutely. So and his life is much more interesting than ours.
That's right.
Ladies and gentlemen, coming down off of a brutal, brutal injury on the basketball court, which in no way has hampered him from creating the awesomeness that he creates from the Jack Palm series, Jack Wakes Up, This Is Life, and Checkmate, to the collection of short stories A Long Way from Disney, The Gritty Tale, Young Junius, and In Broad Daylight, which is currently being serialized in audio form at his website, SethHarwood.com. Ladies and gentlemen, all the way from San Francisco, from Berkeley, we give you on the Skype line and taking up the biggest chair at the round table, Seth Harwood. Seth, thanks for coming back to the show, man, and helping us workshop a story.
Thanks for having me on, guys. Always a pleasure.
Absolutely. Finally get our shit together and decide to actually do what we do. Absolutely.
Right. Yeah.
So, Seth, are you healing? Are you walking? Do you still have two legs?
I'm getting much better. Much better.
Excellent.
I got this walking boot that all ties up with Velcro, and pretty soon it's going to come off, and I'm going to be in normal shoes again.
Ah, yes. And then
those are pretty stylish. I have a lot of students that walk around with those, and
yeah,
like they of get their own the volition chicks. Of their choice.
I'm sure that they wear it a lot longer than they need to.
After 5 weeks and it gets a little old.
I was going to say, style tends to wear out very quickly.
Go back to the big boy shoes.
That's right, man. Get it. And we are glad to hear that the healing process is about done for you, so you can get back to doing the awesomeness that you do, which we're curious about at this point, Seth. You've got an amazing body of work behind you. And I know you've got more coming up. So can you share with our listeners what's next on the Seth Harwood Day Planner?
Well, I've got some great news that I can break here with you.
Ooh, awesome. Awesome.
First of all, Young Junius has been optioned for a movie making thing.
Oh, holy crap.
Badass.
That's huge.
A guy who has done a lot of music videos has optioned Young Junius to make a movie out of it. There will be more details on my website soon, and I'm really excited about that. The other thing that's happening is, I think I can talk about this. It's okay now to say that Amazon has signed on to publish three of my books as part of their Thomas and Mercer line of crime fiction.
Oh,
and
wow.
So they'll be rolling those out starting in the fall.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I'm really pumped. I'm excited to get this all together. We've been doing some negotiating for a while with both of these situations, and I'm pretty much dying to get my pen on the contract and even get a little bit of of coin over here.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations.
That's fabulous.
35 cents.
Bring it. Maybe a buck. Who knows? Yeah. Now, Seth, during our 20 Minutes With segment that aired a couple of days ago, you were talking about crafting your work in a cinematic way, that you know, there's a movie that plays out for the reader as they read your work. Now having a work of yours being optioned for film, how does that feel, man? Because that's got to be not only just a dream come true for any writer, but since you're tied so tightly to that format, what's that doing for you?
It's really exciting. You know, I was able to go online and look at some of the videos that this guy had done and see him directing some actors and characters who looked like ones that I think of and envision in that book in the context of that novel. So I'm really excited to see that he's working sort of with within those settings. I'm excited to see that happen. I mean, yeah, part of what makes me feel like my writing is visual or cinematic is the work that I put in on the dialogue. So to think about that and to start thinking about translating that to the big screen is really exciting to me.
That's outstanding.
I mean, all of it is just, yeah, I'm totally excited.
And a great affirmation for you as an author that people can see your work not only transitioning into other media, but also being showcased so prominently with Amazon. That's fabulous. Are you doing any cons or show appearances at all?
No, I'm really going to take some time off this summer to get some writing. I really want to write exclusively pretty much through July. And then I'll be doing BoucherCon in the fall, which is in Cleveland.
Cleveland, Ohio. Hotbed of crime.
Yes.
The Rock fiction. And crime fiction. Sorry.
And crime writers.
Yeah. Awesome. Very cool. Yeah. Have you ever been in that one before?
I was in BoucherCon a couple years ago in Indianapolis. Had a great time there. And then it was here in San Francisco last year. So that was a great time as
perfect.
Well.
Perfect. Okay. All right. Yeah, very cool. All right, we'll make sure all of that stuff gets into the liner notes. And folks, stay tuned at SethHarwood.com. Breaking news of your favorite gritty author of hard-hitting badassery going to the next level. That's outstanding. That's outstanding. Speaking of badassery, and here's my graceful segue, what do you say we take a break for a badass promo, and when we get back, let's workshop a story?
I think that would be badass.
I think we've established a theme. Awesome.
Yes.
All right, friends, stay tuned. We will be right back.
Hey, you. Stop hiding behind that sofa. Come out from back there. Your sofa wants to talk to you, wants to play footsie with your mind. Listen to it. Relax. Let it in. Starship Sofa. The first podcast ever to win a Hugo Award, with weekly stories from the world's best authors, Michael Moorcock, Peter Watts, Joe Haldeman, Peter F. Hamilton, and many, many, many more, with news and reviews and interviews. Bradbury, Pohl, Wolf, and Mieville, the sofas chewed the fat with them all. Facts and fictions, articles and particles. Oh, why aren't you listening? StarshipSofa.com. Your best science fictional fix this side of the coffee table.
And we're back, ladies and gentlemen. This is the segment that we all look forward to, where we get to jump around with a new story idea. And today we have a really awesome guy on the line that Dave and I had the privilege of meeting up with. He's a guest host on the Secret Project podcast. Dave, why don't you give him your five-star introduction?
Yes, indeed. And I actually had the pleasure of actually meeting him at Balticon. We shook hands. We chest bumped. We bonded as men.
Rub it in.
our guest host began his vocal career, actually, at the tender age of 6 with a Radio Shack cassette recorder. Segue quickly to the winter of 2005, podcasting has made the scene, and of course anybody attuned to the storytelling potential of the audio medium instantly has fallen in love, and our guest writer is no exception. caught up with the whole internet podcast experience, became a founding member of Broken Sea Audio Productions, which gave him tons of experience in writing, acting, and producing audio dramas, which is very cool. As Brian pointed out, he is a co-host with Scott Roche at The Secret Project, which is SeekritProject. We'll put it in the liner notes. but check it out. It's a very cool podcast where they bring projects that maybe people don't know about and shove them firmly into the limelight and let everybody know. He's written short fiction extensively, several of it available in ebook format. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Skype line. Our guest writer for this episode, Mr. David Subkowiak. Dave, welcome to the podcast, man.
Welcome, Dave.
Thank you very much.
All right, now, Dave, from this point forward, you are Dave. Everybody else, call me T-Bone. Otherwise, this is going to just get too crazy. We did this with Brian Lincoln and Brian Humphrey, and it didn't work.
It still didn't work.
So we're going to try, if you want to talk to me, I'm T-Bone. The guest writer is Dave. Everybody clear on that?
Yes.
I like how you're T-Bone and I was Pookie Bear. That's great. Yeah. Thanks, Dave.
Oh, you didn't like that? Anyway, Dave, what got you into writing, man?
Ever since I've been a kid, I've been writing down ideas. I wrote several short stories when I was probably between the ages of 15 and 18.
Wow.
Banged them out on an old typewriter that my parents had picked up from a newspaper that went out of business in our hometown of Buffalo, New York, and handed them out to our friends, to my friends. I had to actually type up copies of the stories since I had no access to a photocopier at the time. So yeah, I spent a lot of time hitting the keys,
infected by the bug of creation.
That is right.
Fabulous. Well, and you have brought one of the spawns of that creative mojo with you, have you not?
I have, indeed.
Excellent. Then this, my friend, is where we turn the mic over to you. You have 5 to 8 minutes. Give us the title, the genre, the format of the book story, whether it's a short story, novel, novella, whatever. Introduce us to some of the key characters. Give us a quick overview of the story arc, and then we'll dig into it, okay?
All right, that sounds great.
All right, the mic is yours, my friend.
Thank you, sir. The novel is named Badland. The genre, it incorporates elements of horror, mystery, and there are some supernatural elements in there. And I think I'm really just going to need some help from you all to kind of narrow down exactly where this would fit. The hook goes a little something like this. In a secluded mountain town, a man struggles against the odds to find his past, discover the secret kept by local clerics, and change the face of his world forever.
Good hook.
Thank you, sir. The story itself is set in the distant future. The human race has been dead for decades, save for the body and minds of several scientists who were tied into a virtual reality system run by an AI that has been designed specifically to keep them alive so that they can find a way to resurrect the human race. It takes care of all their mental needs, all their physical needs, but the system is failing. And the AI is struggling to keep one scientist in particular alive, and that is the system's creator. The reader will not know of any of this until the end of the story. The entire story is told through the protagonist's point of view, and that protagonist is a man named Isaac Denton. He's a man with no memory of himself, the town where he wakes up, or anything going on. He's a strong sense of right and wrong. He despises corruption in all its forms and is immediately at odds with the authority figures in the town where he finds himself. The antagonists of the story are primarily the clerics within this town. They're part of a religious order who control the town's law, the moral code, and the economy. It's headed by a man named Blessed Father Jacob, who is quick to judge and slow to forgive. The town itself is an antagonist as well, in that it sits at the center of a very vast desert, surrounded on three sides by salt flats, and on another by a seemingly endless mountain range. No one has ever come into the town, from anyone's recollection, and no one has ever left successfully. Those attempting to flee the clerics into the desert are met with horrific apparitions of demons and hellfire. The story goes a little something like this. A man wakes in a shabby Old West doctor's office run by a drunken sawbones. He can remember nothing of his past or where he is. There's a woman taking care of him, and she calls him by the name Isaac. She relates that he is in the town of God's Prairie, but can give him really no other information about himself save for an address that was found in the remains of his clothing when he was brought in. His only visitor is the town sheriff, who seems rather surprised that he is still alive. He offers him only one piece of advice, and that is, if he wants to stay that way, he should avoid the clerics at all costs. Isaac presses him for more information, but gets nothing. The woman offers to take him to the address found in his clothing, but on the way, he meets up with two of the clerics he was told specifically to avoid. They're in the process of beating a small boy for suspected stealing, despite the protests of the shop owner to the contrary. Upon seeing Isaac, they flee the scene, their faces completely white. He attempts to check on the boy, but his offer to help is rebuffed, and he is sent away unwelcome, as his very presence seems to frighten the boy more than the attack by the clerics. At his home, which is a ramshackle assortment of small structures held together by rotted wood and aluminum, he finds anachronistic objects strewn about the rooms, which only serve to deepen a disquieting feeling he's getting. In one room, there's a pinball machine sitting against the wall, its plug wires disappearing into the wall where no outlet can be seen. Next to a wash basin and a pump is a microwave with a flashing digital clock that says 12. Throughout the house, pictures and items provide glimpses into his previous life, but he finds receipts from the town that he decides may bring him closer to his identity. In town, he faces more resistance from everywhere he goes. The general store asks him to leave. In the tavern, patrons appear to fear him. Objects within each of the locations bring back memories to him in disjointed visions, but none of them fit within the context of the town or the people or the apparent era in which they are. On the streets, he discovers even more clerics accosting a woman for not bowing to them deeply enough. He confronts them on their behavior and ends up assaulting them and chases them off. Several of the townspeople come out to thank him for his kindness and relate to him that the reason for their mistrust was that they felt that he may be one of the clerics himself. After meeting with the townsfolks, he's still no closer to finding out anything about his past, though many still insist that he had been cast out of the order at one time to die in the wastes. Some even insist that he was once the Blessed Father, only to have been overthrown by Jacob. During this revelation, the mine, which is the town's only form of industry, explodes and caves in on itself. Isaac and many of the townsfolk rush to the mine to rescue those trapped, but they're blocked by the clerics who are controlling the mine. They say the only way that the townsfolk can go and rescue the other people is if Isaac leaves with them to go to the cathedral with them, which is an imposing and dark monolithic structure at the edge of town. Once there, the final confrontation between Isaac and the Blessed Father Jacob commences. Isaac begins to remember his past with the clerics, but even more than that, he remembers scenes of computer labs, wars, and a plan to continue humanity. Upon besting Jacob, the scene changes, and he wakes on a table in a lab. Everything is covered in dust, and the walls are covered with flashing lights, computer terminals, and cameras. Holographic images of Jacob, the woman, and the young boy appear to Isaac and explain his situation. The system is dying, resources have been depleted, and there is no way for the AI to sustain him without murdering the other scientists and ending all chance of saving humanity. The AI argues that as its creator, he should be the one to be saved. Isaac chooses death over the computer's protestations, and after disconnecting from support, slowly fades away with visions of God's prairie filling his mind as his life ends.
So this is like the feel-good hit of the summer, then. Is that what we're going for?
Yes.
Okay. Awesome. Awesome. Yes. Well done, Mr. Subkoyak. Well done indeed. Good pitch.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. So let me ask you this, Dave. First of all, is there anything in particular you want to get out of this discussion we're about to have?
Some ideas about how to craft some of the characters so that, you know, the evil people are really evil, and while the good people are good, they're not sappy. I don't want to have a story where people are just completely cookie cuttered into these are the good guys, these are the bad guys. Everyone has shades of gray in them, and I'd like to pull that out a little bit.
Okay, cool. I think we can help you with that. Brian, why don't you kick us off with a disclaimer, if you would be so kind.
Sure, yeah. On this show, as we kick around this amazing story idea, we're going to be coming up with some equally amazing ideas of our own that you are more than welcome to completely disregard because they're probably complete and total bullshit. So that's pretty much it. Yeah.
There you go. And that applies to all of us, even Seth. Seth may be completely full of shit. So enjoy as you will. So we always defer to our guest host for opening comments, opening questions, points of clarification, whatever. So, Seth, if you'd be so kind, what's your first impressions of Dave's story, and what questions do you have for him? Start us off, man.
So I'm confused a bit. I'm confused about how the computer thing relates. So when you started your description, you started with sort of these people in kind of a stasis being sustained by the computer.
Yes.
The AI, and then Isaac wakes up in the town, and then from the town, ultimately he gets back to where the computer is.
Well, where I began, and I said the story is set in the distant future. That was just to give you a little bit more of an idea of what the relevance of the story time frame was, just for you as you know the the
show. Where does the story start, Dave?
The story actually starts with Isaac waking up in the town.
So the reader, the only thing the reader has to go with is the Old West town.
Yes.
And later on, as the story progresses, weird things happen, and eventually we discover, oh my God, it's actually a constructed environment. It's an artificial environment.
That's correct.
Yeah, so that's my big question. Like, when Isaac is in the town at the beginning of the book, is he really in the town, or is he, like, in some machine, sort of a Total Recall type thing where it's like all happening in his brain?
It's pretty much all happening in his brain.
Right. Okay. So his body is like in the
stasis. In the lab.
The whole time.
In stasis.
Right?
Yes.
Okay. But he sort of wakes up out of that as the story goes along?
Little bits of the real reality start to bleed through into this world that he's existing in.
Yeah.
Within his mind. And when he has the final confrontation with the lead cleric, the computer system can't keep him within that town anymore. And he comes out into the reality of the lab.
So it makes me think of like The Matrix and Total Recall.
There you go. Yeah. I think those are valid analogies.
I mean, I just bring those up just so that I can kind of get my head around this.
Sure.
I'm inevitably kind of flattening it into something that I understand already. So I'd say that those are the two things that I'm sort of using to help understand what's going on here.
Yeah, I think that's very accurate.
Yeah.
I think it's a really interesting story. I think that, you know, there's a lot of creation there that you've already done, and it sounds really interesting. What do you have at this point? Like, you have a big outline?
Generally, yeah, I have a big outline. I have some character sketches that I've done on some of the characters within the story, the woman, Isaac, some of the clerics. That's pretty much where I am right now. I'm in the process of starting to write. I'm still in the first chapter. So, I mean, pretty much it's wide open for me to keep forging dead ahead, or, you know, as I go, see where the movie show in my head kind of takes me, and feel free to, you know, delve off into other areas of exploration within the town.
But I think ultimately that sounds really good. I mean, you know, as you're describing it, I can kind of picture this guy in the doctor's office with that woman. You know, that's your first chapter. You've got the movie of that in your head. Now I think the next step is really to just get it down on paper, you know, write it down chapter by chapter, 500 words or 700 words a day, whatever you can get done, or more than that. And just, you know, chip away at it, unearth it as you go, and continue to find where the characters and the story are going to go. I think, you know, I like what you're saying about worrying about the characters being three-dimensional and having some aspects of good and bad in them. You know, I generally put more stock in kind of finding those characters and letting them be human as you go, as opposed to try and write really human character sketches of them before you've actually started writing the book.
Seth, okay. could you give us an example, like, for example, with Isaac Denton, with Dave's protagonist? You know, and as writers come onto this show, we talk about what works and what doesn't work, at least from our perspective. We've already established that everything we say is bullshit, so bringing out individual perspectives can help Dave understand new perspectives on the characters that have been living in his head for however many months or years he's been developing this. So can you apply some of your craft to his protagonist and see what you might do to explore more depth or more fleshing out of him?
Of Isaac Denton?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, to me, it really feels like one of the real joys of writing is kind of finding the story and finding the characters the same way that a reader does. I mean, the way that we get to know people in life and in reading and writing is through their deeds, through their actions and what they do. And it sounds to me like the stuff that Dave is saying, not T-Bone, but Dave, it sounds to me like the stuff that he's saying in terms of how he treats the kid and how he sort of starts to interact with these clerics and the other people in the town and tries to find these things in his house and stuff. You know, it seems like the beginnings of some humanity and some humanness to the character are there. You know, when we were talking in the showcase section, we were talking about how to really round out these visual aspects and these visual elements. I think as we see Isaac's body, I mean, that's one of the most important things, is to really make sure that as a reader, your reader is seeing Isaac's body throughout the piece. So to really make sure that you're creating scenes that are dramatized visually, you know, it's not just people talking to one another. It doesn't just wind up being dialogue, and it doesn't just wind up being them doing little movements. But, you know, we see these characters moving around. Stay away from thought italics. Show us your characters moving around and interacting in this town, and then that will help you achieve the town really becoming sort of an antagonist, as you said, and the other stuff. Yeah. You know, one of the questions that I had was the clerics running away and their faces were white. What do the clerics look like? Are they people? What is a cleric?
A cleric is a type of priest, monk type. These guys specifically have dark charcoal gray robes.
But black. They look human.
Yeah, they are human.
They have feet?
They have feet. They wear sandals. And they beat the boy.
They wear sandals?
Yes.
Sandals?
It's a desert.
No way.
Okay, they wear, actually, you know what? They don't wear sandals.
Sandals?
No, these guys wear cowboy boots. Everybody wears cowboy boots.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, everybody wears cowboy boots.
Don't let him bully you.
No, I'm not actually.
So I know this happens in the future, but if you had to say, like, visually, like, when is this, like, what time period is this town sort of theoretically set in? Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. This is all taking place in, like, the American Old West.
Okay.
So 1860.
Right. So nobody's wearing sandals. This is an ancient Greece. Are there horses?
Yeah, I got you there. No, there are no horses in this town.
Why?
They're just not there.
No, why?
Do they have guns?
They do have guns. They have guns that the sheriff has a gun. It appears to be a revolver. I haven't really gotten to the point in my head exactly where or when it might be fired.
Someone's going to get shot.
Someone's definitely going to get shot. I'm actually considering, back when Isaac chases off the clerics, for harassing and accosting the woman, that he gets a hold of one of their guns, like a gun, and he shoots one of the clerics. It doesn't kill them, but he you know, injures him, and the other one drags him off. The clerics' only weapons so far that I've had in my mind has been this long black wooden rod, about 3 inches in diameter, that they like to smack people on the head with full force. Which is basically what they were doing to the small boy when Isaac first comes across them.
I'm picturing some like black leather shoes or boots on these guys, not like the pointy cowboy boots.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. Brian, what have you got for first impressions on Dave's story?
Well, as far as the horses go, I think you definitely need to have partially decayed or mummified carcasses of horses. You know, like half buried in the sand. Because here's what I'm seeing this as. This is, and again, the whole bullshit thing. This is totally my interpretation of what you've given me, which is, you know, a 5-minute pitch. I'm seeing this as sort of the wasteland of what once was Isaac's primary construct, what he had envisioned as sort of, you know, they had to have a holding cell to keep their consciousness from going crazy. And so he builds this landscape that, you know, has all of the trappings that they want, everything that they need, and, you know, entertainment. It's got the pinball machine. It's got all these other things and, you know, and laws and guidelines and everything so that they don't go crazy in stasis. And because the system is deteriorating, the construct is deteriorating. And so when he wakes up and doesn't recognize anything and sort of has amnesia or whatever, he's looking around and everything that he, in his previous building of this, had envisioned has completely deteriorated and falling apart, which might also be part of how difficult it is to remember things is because it's not the way that he had built it. It's now deteriorating the way that the AI is deteriorating. So that's kind of my take on it.
That's interesting.
A question that I had though is, his consciousness is here in this construct. What about the other scientists? Are they here as well?
No. Okay. Yeah, well,
the
no.
other scientists aren't the clerics.
Well, that's what I was kind of thinking was
no,
maybe
actually, oh, go ahead.
Well, they're just actually all in Acapulco.
They're all well, in Rio.
As a what if, one of the things that I was playing with is if you have Father Jacob and he's kind of your almost sort of an arch nemesis, you know, at least implied while everybody's afraid of the clerics and, you know, there's this guy that sort of unseated Isaac and that's what the town is telling him. And then he has to meet up with this guy. If Father Jacob was or is one of the other scientists, one of their consciousness, and he has discovered that everything is failing and falling apart and that the AI is going to destroy him in order to save Isaac, and that gives him a motivation to try to destroy Isaac within the construct before Isaac has a chance to communicate essentially with the AI.
Okay.
Just as a thought.
Yeah, I like that.
So
now let me ask you this, Dave. The clerics, what are they in the construct? These clerics are clearly the focal point, the center point around which everything seems to be revolving, especially with their cathedral being a vast Gothic structure, probably the biggest thing in this dwindling virtual reality that they've created. So in your mind, what purpose are the clerics serving in the context of the AI? What do they represent?
My original thought was that the clerics and the cathedral are basically the epicenter of everything that is wrong with
society. So they're a virus?
It's basically a representation of everything that is wrong or everything that was wrong with humanity. And in trying to rebuild and recreate and not resurrect, but in a way to complete the work that they're trying to do, the scientists, okay. They basically took all of this and jammed it into this one sort of construct.
I have a problem with that, because if the sole purpose of the AI is to keep its creator, Isaac, alive, then why present him with conflict and struggle and a dark mirror of society that is going to drive him into depression and, in the current arc as it is, suicide?
Well, I think my original thought was that in building this construct and building this artificial virtual reality where they could go and try to rebuild things for humanity, the cathedral was basically almost like a prison of sorts for everything they didn't want to bring into humanity. And as the system started to decay and it started to lose the ability to maintain itself, things broke down. The cathedral basically became the epicenter for everything that was wrong, which is really what it was. And the clerics basically got out and took over.
Okay. That's, I see what you're doing with that, and I get it. It's not clear.
It's not clear.
It's not clear. It's not going to read. Let me just riff a little bit on this. Sure. and then roll with this. One thing that I think it's important to keep in mind is that this world is Isaac's creation. He built this thing. So whatever is in here has ultimately been touched by his hand, or at least seeded or started by him. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So with that as a foundation, what if we're going to start with a what ifs right here? What if this initial virtual reality? Backing up. Something happened, and you can decide whatever it is, but something happened that drove the scientists into this virtual reality construct. Okay? I don't know if it's relevant to the story, although it might be, is to understand why they plugged into this thing in the first place. Because these were scientists. They were doing stuff. They were trying to save the world. And some event drove the creator and his team to flee the world and stop working to save it, to be preserved in this AI.
Nuclear holocaust.
Yeah, exactly. Or a plague, or you know, the ozone layer completely breaks down and the world has become a crisped desert.
Bath salts.
Okay, fine, sure, that'll work too. Oh.
Zombie apocalypse.
Totally. You know, but and what Brian was asking initially about, are the other scientists in there? I would put to you, just as a suggestion, okay, rather than have, because having just Isaac as the only real quote-unquote character in here with everything else being constructed by the AI, I think that might be limiting you a little bit in terms of the drama that you can unfold in this story.
Okay. Right?
So if six of the 50 people in the village are also people in the construct at the beginning of the story, and as the story progresses, system failures lead to them dying and breaking down. Because ultimately what you're telling here is a tale of deconstruction, of the disintegration not only of civilization and technology, but also of the human spirit and the human mind. I mean, it's a beautiful, beautiful construct, and there's a lot Absolutely. You can do with this.
Yeah.
So, consider that possibility of having other scientists in there. The other thing that I, two other things, and then I'll turn it off, and then I'll get stop talking, is I think Isaac Denton is way too nice. I think if his ultimate choice is going to be to die and give up on humanity and life, then...
No, I thought he was dying because he wants to save humanity.
Right. He's sacrificing himself so that the AI can continue on with the others, I'm assuming, right?
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Scratch that.
So he is nice.
He is nice. Well, okay. Yeah. Then I still think he's too nice because we need a bigger arc. I'm just going to say, if Isaac Denton starts off a despairing bastard and eventually, through the course of events of the story, achieves a transformation, a dramatic character reversal. Yes. That leads him to decide that, yes, life is worth living, or at least the world is worth saving, then his sacrifice at the end has meaning. If he's been a nice guy and a paladin and lawful good from the very beginning of the story, then there's no drama. We know what he's going to do. Of course he's going to throw himself on the sword and take one for the world.
But no.
Yeah.
I think it's still a dilemma at the end, even if he's not such a jerk from the beginning.
True. Well, yeah, and that's a good point. I mean, it is death. It is killing yourself. I'm just all about the big broad arc. So
I know, but then you start talking about broad arc, and it makes me think there's going to be some broad and a love interest and all that stuff to make him realize that humanity is good. And I picture some like John Cicada music in the middle with lots of goo goo eyes, and I don't want that.
All right,
late 80s Chicago.
So what do you want, Seth? I've said my piece. Let's go back to you. We've talked a little bit now. What kind of vision are you seeing here?
I like it as it is. I think he's got some really good ideas. I think the guy, I mean, it seems like to me that the main arc is, you know, it's one of those amnesia stories. Like, Isaac is in the situation. You know they're remaking Total Recall with Colin Farrell?
Yeah, yes. I saw the trailers.
I heard about that.
Why are they doing that?
I have no idea. Well, it was
because they had to get Kate Beckinsale and Jessica Biel in the same movie together to appease me.
Oh. It's your fault. Yes. Well, and it is for Kate Dick.
Schwarzenegger was in that movie, and he wound up in the sand at the end.
With his eyes
bugging
out. His
head is swelling up really big. Right, yeah. And he's like, Malena!
Stella!
I love that. But so
now I got to watch that.
Okay, so this guy, it's like a amnesia type story. The guy has no idea where he's from and what he's doing there. And he's just kind of figuring out this world. Like, that's sort of the major plot of the story, right? Is for him to uncover what's happening in this world.
Basically, yeah. Uncovering what the world is, where he is, who he is.
Right. Who is he, and who is he in this world, and why is he in this world? What do the other people in the world think he is?
Good question.
They don't really know. I've kind of... Like I said, I haven't really written all that much about it, but what I know is that the people in the town are fearful of him. They don't know what to make of him, and you know, it's going to take a lot more than just, you know, beating up or shooting a cleric, you know, in the end or in the middle.
He's a newcomer to the town.
Basically, they see him as a newcomer. They don't know who he is really. Yeah, but he has a house, and that's part of the strangeness of the story. He has some place that's his within the town, but everyone in town treats him like he's not himself.
So is this like in your mind, is this all happening because of some sort of bug in the AI?
In my mind, it's happening because the AI has been running for so long, and it's running out of power. It's running out of resources. It's running out of whatever it needs to keep this group of people alive.
Yeah. That's what I mean kind of by bug.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a problem with the AI. And so the people in the town aren't behaving in a totally rational way.
Right.
Did you ever see that movie Six?
No, I haven't.
Or it was like a mini-series on AMC a couple of years ago with Ian McClellan and Jim Caviezel.
No, but I'll have to look it up.
What's it about?
It's about the... I forget if it's called Six or what it's called, but it's about this... There's this town, and there's this guy that finds himself in the town. He doesn't know how he got there, and the town is run basically by Ian McClellan. All these people in the town are like very happy. They have no problems. And Ian McKellen kind of runs everything, and he always wears a white suit, and he walks around, and this guy that's Six, they just call him Six. Like, he doesn't have a name except for Six, and he doesn't know why they call him Six, and he doesn't know where he came from or how he got there, but basically he's trying to figure out why he's there and why these people are all so happy and everything like that. And basically, you know, it comes down to what the creation myth is of the town and how the town really got created. Nobody can leave the town. There is nothing, essentially nothing in the world other than this small town. So Caviezel kind of has to figure out like how he got there and what's happening, and ultimately he ends up going against McClellan, who's kind of the creator of the town and it's kind of lord or something. And I forget how it all ends up, but yeah, I mean, I think that's pretty, it's pretty well done, and it's based on the recent one that was on AMC was like 6 episodes, and it was a remake of a show from the 50s or 60s that was either a movie or sort of a short miniseries back then.
Huh. I got
it's called The Prisoner.
The Prisoner. Okay, I was going to say, Prisoner. It sounded like that. Okay.
Yeah, and the guy's name is Six. And it's called The Prisoner, and it was based on a thing called The Prisoner from a long time ago.
Yeah, the comic series.
1960s.
Yeah. Oh, no, that was a series. Yeah, okay, cool.
Yeah, I'm actually familiar with the series. And for the life of me, I could not even see that with this until just now.
Okay, cool. Well, we will
You're familiar with the series, The Prisoner?
Yes, actually, at Broken Sea, we actually... produce an audio drama mini series of sorts based on The Prisoner.
Cool. Oh yeah, you should definitely check out this one from AMC. I think it was pretty good. I liked it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Brian, what were you saying, bud?
So I at first I didn't agree with you with the whole, you know, he can't be Mr. Nice Guy from the very beginning. But I think that you have something there, and it could be something as simple as, since he created the AI, maybe he also included a switch to eliminate any, you know, extemporaneous energy sucking, with him being the last one to be eliminated, as a safeguard for himself. And so, you know, it, not to like totally derail the story and turn it into something like Identity, but, you know, you could, if the other scientists are in this town and they start, you know, one by one kind of dropping dead, and there's this also this sort of subplot of a mystery of why these people are just sort of dying off. And as it comes back to him, he realizes, oh, I put this in there. But because of his new experiences, it's sort of changed who he is. And now he has to go in and stop it and then sacrifice himself. Then he's got a whole different kind of internal conflict there.
Because anybody that's building a virtual world, I'm talking with authority about virtual worlds, but I can see people, if you're going to build a virtual world, that you're going to build in interfaces within the world with which to interact with the main core, with the mainframe that's building it. And those interface elements could be very important places in the town. And as the AI has degraded, I mean, initially this virtual world could have been an incredibly vast place set in contemporary times where the researchers were continuing their work. It was easier and faster to work on the problems in the world in the AI because it was at the speed of thought. You didn't have the limits of physical sleeping and actually physically doing things. The AI could create simulations that could solve problems more quickly. And they stayed in there. They made the fatal error of continuing to work past, you know, the computer says, Dr. Denton, you need to get out now and live a little bit before you come back in again. And they're constantly kicking off the failsafe saying, no, we have to keep working. And in doing so, became somehow enmeshed in the AI. They broke it by ignoring the safety protocols. And as things have continually broken down, because there's nobody outside to fix the machine, the world has gotten smaller and has gone back in time, because it's easier to render ancient times like the Old West, because it requires less pixelation, less memory storage, so on and so forth, than it does to render this high-tech, wonderful world. But there's still going to be relics and remnants of that in the world, which explains the weird anachronisms that you have popping up in there.
And it's so archetypal, it's easy for all of them to exist in that kind of a world without having to be self-selected. You know, one in Seattle, one in New York. You don't have to do that because everybody has a very similar idea of what the Old West was.
And because they've been entwined with the AI, that explains why they don't remember who they are.
Right.
Because the AI is actually kind of overwriting their memories somehow. I don't know. I might be going way off.
as the AI is deteriorating, that means that their consciousness is deteriorating as well.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Good point. Exactly. Right? Exactly. And I can see. I'm gonna. Have you ever seen The Village, Dave? M. Night Shyamalan.
No, I haven't seen that one.
Check it out.
Shyamalan, Ding Dong,
baby.
Baby.
whatever weirdness he's come up with since then, this is one of his better stories, I think. And it starts off in this old town, you know, puritanical times, very old.
Salem,
yes, very much so. And through the course of the story, you see weird shit. And it's not like, oh my God, there's a toaster in the middle of the room, but there's just some weird shit. And as the story progresses, the shit gets weirder and weirder until you realize something is seriously messed up in this town. I won't give away the big reveal at the end because it's awesome.
Give it away.
No, I won't do it. I won't do it.
Do it.
No, I don't have to. The point I'm trying to make, Dave, is that
I've seen like 2/3 of the movie. I just want to know how it ends.
Dude, you're gonna have to watch it. You ain't gonna get it from me. It ain't coming from me.
They're really underwater. Is
yeah, right.
Nice.
The point that I'm making is that by putting a pinball machine and a microwave right there in, like, you know, Act One, that might be showing your hand a little early.
Okay.
Because what you've got here is this wonderful, amazing mashup of a Western with supernatural overtones. As Seth pointed out, it's a mystery. It's an unraveling mystery. And then we burgeon into cyberpunk and sci-fi. So, and you don't want to do that all at once. I don't recommend, it's an opinion, that you do it all at once. That you lay down a foundation of Old West and then throw in something weird, something supernatural, something that at least gives the reader who's picking up a spec fic book the sense that there are spec fic elements involved here, but you're not sure what exactly. You know, it might be a hologram, it might be magic, who knows? And evolve that as you go, and then as things get weirder and weirder, then you can start getting more and more of what's actually happening, revealing little bits and pieces of the final story until at last they burst into the cathedral, and that's the central mainframe interface. And that's what the clerics are. The clerics are the antivirus program of the mainframe, trying desperately to keep everyone in line and stop doing weird shit that the computer has to dedicate processing power to.
And maybe that's part of why they're selecting out certain townspeople, is they're sort of the extemporaneous programs that are running that are no longer vital to keeping it alive. And so the clerics go out and they're eliminating those, and he's trying to stop them from it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So so let me check in real quick.
Could rewrite Tron, the last Tron movie, to be this, and it would be great.
Well, it is. This is the Matrix meets the Village. This is the Prisoner. You're drawing on so many awesome tropes. Let me just check in. Seth, have we blown your mind yet?
I'm with you.
Okay, he's rocking. Dave, are we going anywhere near a place that you are thinking is kind of cool, or do we need to derail this and go in a different direction?
I'm writing all this down.
Awesome. 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 So let me ask you this. What is the mine and why does it explode?
Good question.
Oh, I was hoping you weren't going to ask that.
Basically,
what I gathered the mine explosion was like a major system failure within the construct. Well, not within the construct, but within the AI lab. Basically, it was like the final meltdown, so to speak, of some system that was critical in maintaining all of the scientists.
Cool. Awesome.
And basically that's where I was going with
it's the main power grid. It's the main power matrix.
Kind of like that. Yeah.
Cool. Which means it's a coal mine.
Mm-hmm.
Cause that's where you get your power in the Old West days. Right.
Yes.
That's brilliant.
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. So in that coal mine needs to be in the story before we heard about it in your pitch. And I know that there's lots of layering that's going to go on in the telling of this tale, but, the mine just can't suddenly explode in Act Three.
What if he gets dragged out of the mine before he wakes up? And he wakes up and he's covered in coal dust.
I thought the mine exploded before he was in it.
No, no. Well, Oh, before he was in it? It explodes at while he's in the town, right?
Yes.
Like while he's going around. Yeah, so,
but not
so
the mine.
If it's
later on in the story, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
So what I was thinking is if it's a source of power or a source of anything to do with the AI, I don't know where I connected that. Somehow I just was thinking that he was maybe pulled out by townspeople. I'm trying to think of what happened to him.
Why are you going here? What are you trying to construct here, Bri?
I'm not sure anymore.
Okay. When you get that, Brian, do come back, yes. Won't you?
Okay.
Okay, yeah. Cool. One of the things that I'm kind of repeating myself at this point, but one of the things that could be kind of cool is the notion of a reboot sequence or a reboot protocol. That
like at the end of the Matrix.
Exactly. Something along those lines. And maybe that's what happens at the end that triggers the big crisis is that Isaac goes into the cathedral, engages with the interface and seeing how totally screwed up the world has become. Cause really by the end, I mean, there should be some seriously distorted stuff going on.
And then he reboots and he wakes up in the doctor's office.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
All over again.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's like the Dark Tower.
Or Groundhog Day.
It's the Groundhog
See, Day. See, we're tapping every...
Merovingian.
Well, and honestly, you know, I while we don't want to rip off, and as Murr pointed out, no, a professional does not rip off. A professional takes, steals gratuitously.
Steals.
Yeah, improves. Absolutely.
Right. Steal like an artist.
The
T.S. Eliot said.
Yeah, the Matrix is not the only story where people are in a construct. I can't remember the name of the story, but there was one where these guys had created a virtual game world, and there was something weird in the virtual game world. And what it turns out is that they were in the virtual game world the whole time, and if they drove too far in one direction, everything kind of derezzed. You know, so this is not a new theme, but what you can do with it and, you know, draw from those elements like The Prisoner, as Seth said, you know, from The Matrix, from Total Recall, and find those glorious elements that twigged for you, Dave, and incorporate them into this story to tell this unique tale and this unique perspective that you've got. And one other side thing, one other detail thing, you have Isaac chasing away the clerics because they're terrified. What if the clerics are indeed the antivirus of the computer? What if he just tells them, leave the kid alone, and they go blank and walk away? Because he's the creator.
Right. I
don't get it.
Oh, okay.
You know, and now eventually the AI...
More violence. No, more violence.
Then. Well, yes, there must be more violence. Well, and eventually the AI... The AI would respond to that and say, no, my creatures must have more power. And I can see them actually trying to neutralize Isaac because he's a disruptive influence and he's screwing with shit. So like they're trying to, and they think he thinks they're trying to kill him. They're just trying to neutralize him so he will just sit down and be quiet. So yes, or lots of violence.
Drag him into see Father Jacob. So they're coming after him.
To get a reattunement. Yes.
And all of the other characters that are trying to save themselves or running programs in the background or whatever are trying to help him get away from the clerics when really what he needs to do is go with them. Sure. But he doesn't know that.
You know, and the AI, it sounds like the AI is insane. The AI has fractioned some of its processors in an effort. It had to shut down certain power grids and certain, you know, neural connections to sustain things. So it has actual processors within itself that are warring against itself, not necessarily working in concert, but all within this very neutral virtual world where the final days of humanity are playing out. God, it's awesome.
I did have some original notes that talked about the AI suffering a schizophrenic break.
Yes, absolutely.
And the original thought was that Isaac was going to sacrifice himself, and then the AI was going to have the schizophrenic type break, and while keeping everyone else alive, it was going to blame them for his death.
Oh.
And start to basically, you know, attack them because he's not there anymore, and he was its creator.
Right.
So basically, it's God killed himself, and so he was going to go after.
So you're going to need to evolve a personality. Yeah, that's the other, you know, you said the town was a character. Actually, well, the AI is the character.
Yeah, the town could be like the representation of the AI as a whole.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that.
I like that.
Yeah, yeah.
The town is the AI.
Bam. Yes, absolutely. And that gives you,
I like the name of the town.
God's Prairie.
Yeah.
So is Isaac a religious man?
Oh, no.
He's a scientist. Oh.
So why?
Well, and maybe he has a God complex, and so since this is his construct, it's his prairie.
Yeah,
that could be.
Okay,
that's actually very plausible.
There needs to be a reason why all of this religious motif is appearing in his creation, and you know the God complex is perfect.
Yeah,
you know, but in that respect, then he should be the God, not the penitent who's having to struggle and be thwarted by this. But I think there's a thread to explore there. I think that's good stuff. Right. Guys, I'm watching the clock tick down a little bit. Dave, is there anything that you either wanted to ask Seth in particular or that you were hoping we would discuss during this conversation that we haven't gotten to yet?
I think you guys have really hammered some really good ideas into my head. For some options that are there now and some ways of looking at things a little bit differently, just kind of turning the story on its side and viewing it from a different angle.
Cool. Well, yeah. Then let's go around the table one time and give some final advice, final observations, final suggestions to Dave. Seth, final wrap up and advice for Master Dave.
No sandals.
No sandals.
No sandals.
Black boots, baby. And more violence.
Yeah.
Black boots and violence.
No John Cicada music.
No, yeah, okay, yeah. No John Cicada music.
No John Cicada.
I can totally get down with that. Cool. Bri, what about you, man?
So Isaac is pulled from the mine.
Did you finally figure this out? Okay, all right.
I still don't have it.
You don't have it. Let it go.
No. You know what it was? What I was thinking is because you were talking about the mind being a source of power, and if the power is deteriorating, then I was trying to come up with, you know, why what happened to him that he's waking up in the first place? He's just waking up? You know,
it was the last reboot.
Well, I know, but you came up with that after my mind thing that I kind of failed on. And so what I had been thinking was, you know, maybe within the construct, he's noticing that there's some power failure. He goes down into the mine to check it out, and something goes wrong in there where he blacks out. They pull him out, and then you have a connection to the mine when the mine explodes, and that can bring back even more of, oh crap, I was down there and there was something I was looking at, and because I didn't get a chance to fix it, now this whole thing is going to collapse.
Sure.
Maybe, so I think that was where I was going with
maybe
that.
He initiated the reboot down in the power core in the mine, and it was, you know, the 1990s, and at this reboot suddenly poof, everything is now the old west because the last reboot didn't take so well, and here we go.
But maybe the people in the town who are at the doctor's office and the sheriff and the girl, their knowledge of Isaac includes, I mean, Dave said that he got injured and that they couldn't believe that he was still alive. Maybe they know that he got injured in the mine and that's all they know.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Good. And there's a nice clue to pursue, which drives him back into the mine, which could be where some of this first weirdness starts. That's awesome.
Yeah,
that works. I like that.
Yeah, cool. You redeemed yourself, Brian. Well done, sir.
Oh, good.
You can stay on the show. Well done.
Yay.
Any other thought, final words for Master Dave?
So the only other thing that I wanted to say is that this is fucking brilliant, and I'm super, super, super excited to take a look at it when it's done. So
thank you so much.
Definitely keep you know, keep in touch with us and let us know how it goes.
I will.
I have so much love for this story idea, Dave. Yeah, holy crap.
Thank you so much, guys. That means so much.
No, this has all of the makings. It has all of the pinnings of a serious, wonderful mystery, some incredibly creepy supernatural stuff. Just the whole mashup concept. I haven't heard a lot of story pitches that do such a wonderful mashup of so many genres. And I think it's going to be a real challenge for you as you write this, is to be very clear in terms of the genres that you're representing here. The Old West, the horror, the supernatural, the mystery, and ultimately the science fiction, which underpins everything. So, you know, I don't envy you the task ahead. And I see a lot of note cards and outlines in your future. But definitely, I think, respect those genres. Respect the pacing of your story. Don't give everything away too soon, too early. A little weirdness goes a long way. And then the layering of that weirdness and the acceleration of the strange corruption that's unfolding in here will just get everybody's heartbeat pounding. And as Seth said, more violence, definitely. And black boots, that's a win all the way around. So
yeah. I think it sounds really good. I think, you got your work cut out for you. Now you just got to go write it.
Yes. Right. Absolutely.
And the real challenge, it almost seems to me like a very small pond with 1,000 fish that you have to determine which ones you're not going to include so that the other ones can thrive. And that's a tough job, because this is so rich. There are so many different ways that you can go with this that you could spend the rest of your life writing, you know, 50 different versions of it. And every Seth one says, of them would be epic. You know?
As Seth says, and as you say, Brian, just go write, dude.
Right, yeah.
Just go write it. Don't worry about which things are going to be a big part and which aren't. Just start writing and see which comes in.
Yeah, there's going to be going to be a lot of editing, but that's the job. That's
sweet.
The job.
Yeah.
All right. Wow. Well,
thank you
literary
so much,
gold.
Guys. I really appreciate it.
You are definitely so very welcome. And
thank you for bringing it in.
Yeah. Seth, thank you, man, so much for wading in and coming in with guns blazing and helping out with this story idea. I hope you had a good time.
Yeah. No, thanks for having me on, guys. No sandals.
No sandals.
No sandals. No sandals.
More violence. Got it.
I'll rename the book Black Boots and Violence.
See, there it is. Awesome. There it is. An homage to Seth Harwood.
That's right.
Cool. Thanks for having me on, guys.
You are very welcome, Seth. We appreciate your time. And Dave, we definitely appreciate you ponying up the story. I know it's never easy to put your babies out in the spotlight, but she shined, man. This is gorgeous.
Thank you so much.
This is gorgeous.
Definitely.
Oh, baby. Brian, any final words as we ride off into the digital sunset?
Well, I'm exhausted, but I'm still going to go right.
Yes, absolutely.
Wow, right. Great. Good job.
Yes. Awesome. Get it on, man. Get it on. And you, dear friends who have tuned in, whether it's the day this thing drops or 5 years from now when society has derezzed and you're sitting in an Old West town wondering why is there only one town in these podcasts, it's because we are the AI, and it's good that you're listening to us now. So, was that weird or what? But regardless, thank you for tuning in. We appreciate it. Drop us a line out at the Roundtable Podcast website, roundtablepodcast.com. If you've got some ideas or insights that'll help Dave continue working on the story, then drop them in the comments section. We'd love to hear from you there. Rate us on iTunes or leave a review. We'd love to hear what you have to say. Drop us a line at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Follow us on Twitter @writerspodcast. We tweet a lot. We'd probably tweet a little too much, but tweet us out there as well. As Brian said, go write, go make amazing stuff. You have the seeds of awesomeness within you. Go find them and put it on paper, and then bring it on the show, and we'll help you make it even more awesome. Stay tuned. In a few days, we'll have a new guest writer, a new guest host, more workshops, more showcases. The awesomeness flows like fine wine here at the Roundtable. Until then, you guys take care of yourselves. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This episode is copyrighted 2012 by the Roundtable Podcast and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike license. That means don't sell it, but you can share it all you like.
And you can even use pieces of it in your own derivative work, as long as you attribute us as the source and release the work under the same licensing terms. Theme music composed and performed by the talented Hepcats of Brotown, Gary Gold, David LaBruyere, Billy Nobel, and Matt O'Donnell. If you'd like to be a guest writer or guest host, or learn more about the Roundtable Podcast, please visit our website at www.roundtablepodcast.com or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/roundtablepodcast. Our Twitter tag is at writerspodcast, or just send us an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.